This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It's really great to be here. I just want to thank the organizers for inviting me here to come participate and to share our story of my family and how the diagnosis of my daughter led us to completely change kind of everything that we were doing, kind of embrace being part of this community of neurodevelopmental disorders and try to make an impact in the ways that we can. So first, let me tell you a bit about me, about my background. I actually grew up in France. My dad is French, my mom is Canadian. And I grew up in Paris, went to a bilingual school that was an international school founded by NATO after World War II. So really grew up in kind of a diverse community, accepting of people coming from all over the world in different cultures and different backgrounds. And I fell in love with science, initially because of TV shows like ER and medicine, but you know, then learning more about it in the lab and kind of trying to understand how cells worked. And I thought that this was really fascinating. And so I ended up going to McGill University in Canada for my undergraduate degree and studied biochemistry, so how cells work, really, and the nitty-gritty of all the intricacies of how cells work. And that was really fascinating. I'm fascinated by history and was able to take a minor in history of science and medicine and really also try to understand how society and politics and, you know, people shape how science is done and the relationship between all these different factors and, you know, not just the nitty-gritty science, but the medicine and the families and the people that are impacted by this. And I really enjoyed that and thought I wanted to go into medicine, but as I learned more about research, that's really what caught my eye and really making the ability to make new discoveries. And so I actually went back to Europe, to the UK, to do my PhD in neuroscience, and I was studying the brain, and I was studying how cells are newly generated in the brain. For a while, we thought that what the cells we were born with were kind of it, but then we've discovered two regions in the brain where we can continue to make new cells into adulthood. And some of these cells can be involved in memory or brain repair, and so I was studying this process. And I was really fascinated by it, but because we didn't really know what these cells were necessarily doing in the context of disease, I wanted to work on something that was more translational, that could be more relevant to a disease and potentially develop treatments. And so I started thinking of how I could apply my knowledge of neuroscience to other diseases and got really interested in cancer. And so there's actually a lot of similarities emerging, and the similarities between cancer and other disorders. Cancer is a disorder where, you know, cells just kind of get out of control in order to grow and take over things. And these cells can take on features of other cells, like cells of the brain or cells of the blood or fat cells. And so these cancer cells are just really good at taking advantage of whatever they can. And there's some interesting overlap between cells involved in the brain and cells involved in cancer. So I moved to Boston, to MIT, and I did some work there on breast cancer. And so then I became a professor, which was really exciting. Started my own independent research lab focused on cancer and studying how cells spread throughout the body, a process called metastasis, which is what ultimately leads to patients dying. And, you know, this was really fun and really great. I love being a professor, being able to train lots of students and inspire the next generation of students while doing impactful research. But, you know, I was really committed to cancer. And so for this story, too, I need to introduce my husband. He's a professor as well. We met at a research conference, and he is at MIT, and he's been interested in genes for his whole career. For his PhD, he actually developed a software to be able to identify, you know, when we sequenced the genome and we could see all these sequence of the DNA, you know, we had to figure out, well, which gene does that correspond to? And so he developed a software for that. So he's applied a lot of his computational expertise to studying biology. And so he has a lab at MIT. And so we met and, you know, everything was great. We decided to get married and, you know, planned our wedding for April 2020, which you may remember was a pretty life-changing event. And we were due to get married April 20th in California, actually, because that's where he's from. Had this amazing wedding planned, and, you know, as things were starting to look bad early March, we had to cancel it all at the last minute. Our venue is actually in the Bay Area. It was being used to, like, store those initial COVID patients from that cruise, you know, so we got a good cancellation fee, like, pretty easily, which was great because, you know, we definitely couldn't have an event there. So we got, you know, a lot of our money back, and we thought this was probably the most dramatic thing that would happen to us, canceling our wedding, right? How dramatic that we had to do this. So we ended up getting married really quickly at City Hall in Boston, the day that the whole world shut down, and just had a quick wedding, the two of us, as, you know, we had to then leave to go shut down our labs right after this too, because the universities has announced that we were shutting down everything and all the students were going home. So, you know, it was a quick celebration, but again, we thought, okay, this is like the craziest story that's ever going to happen to us at this point. But then our daughter was born, Margot. And so she was born on St. Patrick's Day in 2021. And, you know, I had a super easy pregnancy. It was during COVID. I was at home in leggings all day on Zoom. It was great. Had super easy delivery, 5 hours from start to finish. I was like, I am rocking this. Like, I am so good at this. This is so easy. Don't know what everyone's talking about. I got really lucky. Like, life is good. And so I felt really good about that. And so, initially, things were great, and then 3 months in, and just a warning that there is a video of a little seizure on here, but it's pretty minor. I was holding Margot in her chair in her room, and she had these weird facial movements, and I initially, like, right away took out my phone because I thought they were quite weird because they seemed so repetitive, and took a video of them, and didn't think much of it, I definitely was concerned. Sent them to our pediatrician, and because she kept having them throughout the day, and she told us to go to the ER at Boston Children's to go get checked out because they did look suspiciously like seizures. And so she had an EEG where they recorded her electrical activity in her brain, and she had seizures while on EEG, which, you know, at least is a comforting thing, because nothing worse than seeing something in your child and you go to the hospital and they stop doing it, right? And you're like, oh, this is so annoying. I saw this, you know, so at least I was like, okay, they captured it. They saw what we saw, and we can hopefully get to the bottom of this. And, you know, I right away thought, you know, this is just nothing. This is just a little thing. I thought, you know, we had actually just started a medication for reflux, which is like a really common one. But, you know, because my husband and I are scientists, we were looking up papers and found some obscure paper that said that, you know, this drug can cause seizures. We were like, that's what it is. That's what it is. It's the drug. And so we were trying to, you know, just hold on to kind of anything that this was just a blip. But they did extensive testing. Initially, they said it could be caused because of a tumor or because of a genetic disorder. Being a cancer researcher, the thought of a tumor really scared me. But thankfully, the MRI was clear, and there was no tumor. So they decided to send out for genetic testing. Which, you know, even as a scientist, I mean, we're all for getting as much data as possible, but I think we really didn't expect anything would come back. I mean, part of it is like being a parent, you think, no, there's nothing wrong here, like there's no issue, I know that. But the other part was just not really, you know, even though I knew that, you know, changes in DNA impact biology, and in cancer, you know, there's tons of mutations, you know, issues with the DNA of tumors that cause these tumors. But a lot of the time, you can't do that much about it. So I wasn't really, you know, thinking that this could help or do anything. But we agreed to it to send that out. And so we sent out these samples, and thankfully Margot did respond well to the first medication that she tried. And so we were able to go home, and again, kind of hoping this was nothing. But a few weeks later, she had her four-month appointment at the pediatrician, and it became clear that she wasn't really hitting the milestones. You know, this was my first child, so I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I feel like I was trying to get, you know, those cute pictures where the baby's like holding their head up, pushing up, and I was like, why can't I not get that? She keeps falling over. She can't lift her head up. Like, you know, I was starting to be concerned, and our pediatrician, you know, confirmed that, you know, she was definitely behind by that point. But again, you know, maybe it was just because she'd had this hospitalization and these seizures, and that, you know, it would be okay. So we started therapy and early intervention and got that going. And then, but again, thought kind of nothing of it until early August, we got the genetic diagnosis. And so we got her genetic report, and they had sent out an epilepsy gene panel where you test for a subset of genes that are known to cause seizures. And she had two mutations in this SCN8A gene. And so one of these was of unknown significance, so had not been found before in other patients. And one of them actually had been found in another patient with seizures. So, you know, this was deemed to be a likely pathogenic variant. And so this obviously changed everything, the fact that there actually was a diagnosis, and, you know, that there was a cause and that it wasn't just some isolated incident. And just these seizures that came out of nowhere that we could assign to something random. So going back to kind of how the brain works and how this is involved. So, you know, our neurons are the cells in the brain that regulate the activity. And, you know, all signals within our body are sent through electrical signals in the brain that can then translate to chemical signals in other parts of our body, you know, to allow our brain to control what gets done in our body, and cues from our body impacting how our brain responds. And so generally there's a balance of activity in the brain between positive electrical activity that drives a current and drives a signal, something to happen, and a balance of inhibitory activity that prevents things from happening. And in the body as a whole, this balance of, you know, something happening versus something being controlled and stopped is really important for every aspect of our body. And usually many disorders are due to, you know, an imbalance in those two kind of characteristics. So here, what was happening with Margot is that she was having too much of that excitatory electrical activity that was causing these seizures. And that was because of this mutation in this sodium channel, this gene called SCN8A. So what do we know about this gene? I think sometimes, you know, there's a big push in the neurodevelopmental community to go for genetic sequencing and try to figure out what the root causes of the issue. And some people, you know, feel like it's not helpful. And for us, you know, really getting a diagnosis was really, really helpful in so many different ways. And part of that was because actually there's been a lot of research on this gene. And so Miriam Meisler, who's a professor at University of Michigan, had actually discovered this gene in mice in 1995, so a while ago, and has committed her whole career to studying this. And so she even has SCN8A as the license plate on her car, which is pretty cool. And so she discovered this gene and figured out that it was regulating this electrical activity in the brain. And she thought that, you know, if this was mutated in patients, this could likely cause a seizure disorder or some kind of neurological disorder because it was such an important gene in regulating the activity of the brain. But, you know, she only hypothesized that, and that was not known because all the work was done in mice. And it wasn't until 2013 when another dad, Michael Hammer, who's a professor at the University of Arizona, and he was studied genetics and evolution, and his daughter Shay was having seizures and had autistic features and intellectual disability, and no one knew the cause. And this was really frustrating for him as a geneticist. And so he actually paid for whole genome sequencing on his entire family, which back in like 2011 was about $40,000 total for all of them. But this technology was becoming more available, and he really wanted an answer as to like what was driving this in his daughter. And so they did that, and they identified the first human mutation in SCN8A in the gene that, you know, caused epilepsy. And Shay sadly died of SUDEP, which is sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. But, you know, she really helped fuel this field forward. And then her dad himself changed his whole research to work exclusively on SCN8A and has been really a leader in our community. And initially started with a registry of patients and kind of trying to collect information on, you know, what patients with this mutation, as more than were starting to be found from other sequencing studies, you know, what this disorder really was, right? What do mutations in SCN8A actually do to the brain, and how do they impact people? So, you know, the power of parents really is really impressive. And so this led to two different foundations forming in our community, the SCN8A Alliance and the Acute Syndrome Foundation, that both help support families and have really helped to kind of bring our community together. And we have different Facebook groups that families can join when they are diagnosed. And so we were able to join those right away and right away meet a lot of families that had a similar diagnosis and were dealing with similar things, which, you know, when you get such a diagnosis, it's so isolating, and meeting families who are dealing with the same thing is really so important. So how does SCN8A, what do we know about it now, 10 years later? We just published this study with many clinicians and researchers on characterizing SCN8A in humans. And so there's actually quite a spectrum, and I think this is often the case with many genes that are mutated that play a role in the brain. Depending on where the mutation is in the gene, what impact it has on the protein, you can have very different phenotypes or kind of features that are present in patients. And that's what makes these disorders very interesting, but also very challenging in order to identify the right treatments, or you know, even identify yourself within a community, because there can be such a spectrum. And so SCN8A is similar in terms of many other genes, where you have some of the population that has seizures and some that don't. And so on the seizure side, we have three different groups. And a more severe side with early seizure onset, really, really severe developmental delays and even regressions, and, you know, rarely obtaining any seizure freedom or development. And then there's a more moderate form where seizures happen later in life, and, you know, there can still be improvements and seizure control. Then there's this part where the selfie, which is self-limited, where it starts right away, but then the seizures go away, and the patients can develop typically. And then we have two categories of no seizures that have, and here it's interesting because it's not quite fully autism. There are autistic features, there is intellectual disability, there's movement disorders, there's behavioral issues. And so, you know, there's a lot of kind of different features. And interestingly, you know, a large part of our community so far has been more on the severe side, because those are the patients that get seen quicker for genetic testing. But as genetic testing has become, you know, much more common, and especially for, you know, children who don't have seizures but have other, you know, neurodevelopmental features, our group of patients without epilepsy is growing faster every day, and we are getting a lot of patients now coming in without epilepsy with these other features. So we expect this group to grow a lot as well, especially as genetic testing continues to expand. So it's quite a diverse disorder. And so coming back to Margot, where does she fall? And so unfortunately, she falls in the severe category. I think for a long time, my husband and I were really hopeful that she would not be on the severe end. And I think that sometimes it can be hard when you come into a community with such a wide spectrum, is you see some kids that are doing really great and some that are not doing as well. And you're like, okay, my kid's going to be on the side that does really great and it's going to be good. But you know, slowly you realize, obviously not all the kids will have the same outcome. And so it took us a while to realize kind of where she would fall and kind of what her prognosis would be. And but this is kind of what we've dealt with. It's a lot of seizures. So this is me tracking her seizures daily as a scientist. Obviously I collect a lot of data. And so, you know, over the last 3 and a half years, she's had, you know, over 18,000 seizures, some up to about 160 a day. And we've had some really bad times, and then some, you know, in the last year and a half, things have been pretty calm, which has been really great, and we've had a lot more stability. We've tried 11 anti-seizure medications and the ketogenic diet, and you know, a lot of, some work for a bit, then they stop working. Some have really horrific side effects that we have to stop them because of the side effects, and we can't get to a high enough dose. And there's a lot of tuning, right? Because these meds mess with the brain, and then they get really sleepy or they get really angry, and you know, you have to like lower the doses for that, but you know, still try and balance the seizures. So there's a lot of fine tuning to try and get to like the right place that, you know, allows them to have that, you know, as much seizure control as possible without also compromising quality of life. And so, again, I'm grateful that in the last year and a bit, we've had really good stability. We haven't been to the ER for seizures in almost 2 years in January. And so that's pretty exciting and really great for us. And we've kind of given up on the idea of seizure freedom, but her seizures are short and don't seem to impact her too much. So, you know, right now she has on average 3 to 5 a day, and that's pretty good for us. Unfortunately, this also has come with lots and lots of hospital admissions, ER visits. We've spent her birthday in the hospital, Christmas in the hospital, Halloween in the hospital. Boston Children's is like a second home to us. And while, you know, these have been really hard, especially initially, now, you know, we've come to feel pretty comfortable in the hospital. And we come in with like big suitcases, and I bring my own pillow and blanket and everything. And I'm like, gonna be comfortable if I'm gonna be there. And so we've come to, you know, make the most of it. Because a lot of these neurodevelopmental disorders are not just seizures, are not just neurological symptoms, right? And I think this, no matter kind of where on the spectrum of severity your child falls, there are other issues, right? Because we know that the nervous system controls, you know, so much within our bodies. And so in terms of other features, this is for SCN8A, but this, you know, is applicable to so many different genes and neurodevelopmental disorders. There's issues, can be issues with vision, there can be issues, respiratory issues, GI issues are really common. And so, you know, sleep issues, right? Like these mutations and these disorders don't just affect one system in isolation. And there's just a lot more going on. And so Margot's, you know, has cortical visual impairment where her brain is fine, where her eyes are fine, but her brain cannot see, you know, and she's, you know, profoundly disabled, never gained head control or any kind of muscle control in any way. And she's had a lot of respiratory issues, is on oxygen every night at home, and is very susceptible to respiratory disorders. And I think that's something that, like, clinically is still, I mean, clinicians appreciate that our children deal with a lot of different things, but I feel like it's not as much understood up front, and scientifically it's still very much not understood, you know, why you have all these other issues in the rest of the body, even though it's something in the brain that is impacted. And I think there's a lot that needs to be learned. So, you know, how have we dealt with this, and what have we done to, you know, kind of cope with this and also make the most of this situation? And so the first thing was really sharing our story. That was really important to us because we felt so isolated, like we didn't know anyone that had dealt with anything like this before. And we felt that if we could tell other people, more people could know that these things happen and that, you know, we could maybe get other people to take note and, you know, maybe get interested in researching on this. So I initially got invited to write a post on a blog post from a company that works in genetics and just kind of sharing just, you know, her diagnosis and just kind of how it impacted me as a scientist. I think initially I just felt like a lot of anger towards the process of cell biology, which I teach sophomores in biology at Tufts, and I teach them about mistakes in the DNA that happen, you know, and how the cell is normally really good at repairing the DNA when a mistake happens. But, you know, obviously that process failed for my daughter, and I felt very angry at biology that it did not repair my daughter's DNA when it should have, you know? And initially that class was, like, really hard to teach because it just made me so angry. And so initially really coming to it from that perspective. And then I turned to social media to find other families that were dealing with this. This was also during COVID still, so it was harder to meet people. And on Instagram, I found lots and lots of families that were sharing. And I looked up hashtags for the different types of seizures that Margot had or the gene and found lots of families sharing their story. And so I decided to start an account for Margot where I also share her story. And, you know, just seeing other people living with children who were impacted in similar ways was just really helpful for me because I felt that, you know, these people who were sharing seemed, you know, very normal, very much like me. And if they were able to do it, then maybe I could do it too. And so I'm so grateful for the people that do share their stories and that, you know, kind of put their children out there and the way that they live their lives, because for me it was such a beacon of hope to be able to see that, you know, these families, you know, seem to be, even amongst all the struggles, you know, being able to live fulfilling lives no matter the outcome of their children. And so I've made so many great friends and connections through social media. You know, being able to meet other families that were going through the same thing. And that's also really helped me because I think, you know, finding your people is really important. I just could not relate to any of my friends who were having kids at the same time as me because they were all just, you know, talking about all the things that their kids could do. And I was like, this is not my life at all. I feel like I have nothing to talk about. And you know, people complain about silly things, and you're like, this is nothing. you're so lucky. I wish that was my problem. You know, and it's not to, like, put down, you know, other challenges that people go through, and we all go through difficult things in raising our children, but I think, you know, I just needed to find people that could really relate to the challenges that we were dealing with. And so I'm really grateful that our early intervention group through Perkins School for the Blind, which is in Boston, organizes an infant-toddler group where there's time for the kiddos and then there's time for the parents. And so the parents get to meet and they bring the parents together, which I know very few groups do that. And that was amazing. So it was all families in Massachusetts dealing with different levels of issues, but all with kids with disabilities. And so initially I met two moms and we started doing things together, and then met more moms through that group or through our early intervention providers, kind of connected us, and it's grown to this really great community. This was for Margot's birthday. We rented a roller skating rink this year, and we had, I think, about 30 families or so of all kids with range of disabilities just taking over and, you know, just really finding our people. And these are the moms. Obviously, moms, besties are critical. This is my medical moms group. And, you know, their kids range from different diagnoses, all mostly kind of neurodevelopmentally. You know, we have a monthly mom meetup And we have a very active WhatsApp group. And, you know, we share resources and struggles. And it's just everything for me to have this amazing group of parents close by that I can count on. But, you know, I had to work to build that community and get, you know, put myself out there and meet people. And some parents, you know, want to do that and some don't. So it's really kind of up to you. But for me, it's been really helpful. And then I've even ended up meeting all these moms I met on social media. So this one mom who lives in LA started this Electric Love Retreats, look it up, for disability moms. And she plans these adventure retreats. So we went hiking in Zion and did the Narrows with 32 moms that I never met from social media, which I feel like people are like, you're going to go meet all these random moms on Instagram? I'm like, yes, in the middle of Utah. Yes, I did. And it was the best thing ever. And so she plans these adventure retreats and, you know, just kind of getting out there. And, you know, because we see our lives as pretty hardcore, raising these kids that have a lot going on. And so being able to go out there and, like, be hardcore in a different way has been really great. And then for Margot, you know, trying to figure out how we can adapt to life with her. Like, how do we, you know, have a life with a child with such significant disabilities? This is just not something you are trained to do or you are taught how to do. And initially, you know, we focused a lot on therapies because that seems to be what everyone does. And you're initially just really focused on, I need to fix my child, and the therapies are what's going to do it, and this is what I need to do. And so we have a great therapy centers nearby, and so we just loaded up on therapies, like, constantly. But slowly I realized that, you know, that's a lot. And one, I started realizing that, unfortunately for Margot, given the severity of her diagnosis, therapy is just not helping that much. Like, she really has not gained, like, a single skill, really. And she, you know, was sometimes really miserable in therapy. And it's hard to know, like, what is worth it or what is helping or what to do. But then if you don't do it, you feel really bad that, like, you're not doing enough, right? And, like, it's really hard. So it took a while, but now we've kind of really toned down on the therapies. You know, it's important, and she does great therapies at school and stuff, but, you know, we've really toned down because it's a lot to drive her to all these places too. And, you know, it's, you know, we can't do everything. And what we've really focused on is our quality of life. And that's really what matters to us the most. My husband and I love to travel, and so we've gone lots of places with her. She loves to swim, and so we swim in the water. She just got a hot tub through Make-A-Wish, and we swim every weekend, which is really fun for her. And some trips have looked different. You know, we have to bring our oxygen with us. We're out by the pool with oxygen on. That's just how it is. We bring a lot of equipment. And initially, it was kind of hard to deal with that. But now, I'm just like, that's our life, you know? And we want to enjoy it. And Margo loves to be outside and do things like this. And so we're just going to do what we can. And so this summer, we even went to Paris for the Paralympics. So it's where I'm from. And it was the most amazing thing. And for any of you local California families, if you want to go to LA, highly recommend going to the Paralympics. It is mind-blowing. It is an event where disability is king, and there's nowhere else like that. And everyone who is there, you know, there's so many disabled individuals, a lot of physical disabilities, but also intellectual disabilities, and the range that you can see in sports, and just how people have adapted, right? And the little things that you can do to make something accessible to someone. And between the volunteers and the athletes and the people that came out to watch these events, it just was amazing. So highly recommend it. In Paris, the tickets were really affordable for the Paralympics. So we got to watch tennis at the Roland Garros, like the main Paris Open venue, front row, for like $80 each or something. So it was like really special to do all of this and just be so kind of, just disability was everywhere and it was just normal. And that was really, really cool to see. And so then I've also started getting involved in advocacy and different work. And, you know, what I really kind of, as was mentioned a bit in some of the intros, right, this how do you connect the scientists and the families and the clinicians and bringing kind of that. And so I really tried to be a resource and a bridge to explain the science to the families and also explain to the families how science is done. Because I think, you know, it can be really hard to come into this world and think, okay, I want a cure for my kid. And you know, trying to understand how science gets done and what needs to get done. And then similarly for parents, when they get a diagnosis or can read a paper, you know, trying to figure out how to, you know, how to digest all this information and what does all of this mean. And so I do a lot of science communication on Margo's Instagram page and explain lots of things. Also, speak at different conferences or on podcasts to really break things down and try to explain things to families, because I think that's really important. And being able to do that is critical. And I also now really integrate that into my teaching and in my classes, where I make students make like TikTok videos about science contents and stuff so that they learn, you know, the basic concepts, but they also know how to break them down and explain it to someone who's not a scientist, because I think those are such critical skills to do. I've been heavily involved with one of our foundations, the International SCN8A Alliance, in publications and kind of those kind of categorizing patients and working with clinicians. And we also organized a big conference this summer on our gene in Boston that my husband and I hosted, bringing together same, you know, families, scientists, biotech, and clinicians to spend 2 days really brainstorming on like what are the big needs of our community and how, what are the best steps to move this forward. And like I said, integrating that into my work. So I also run this seminar series in our graduate program at Tufts and have added lots more content on disability as we tackle different concepts. I've always been an advocate for diversity and equity and inclusion, but I think you know, disability is never discussed enough or included enough in a lot of these efforts. And you know, I definitely was not as open to that world for a long time. And I feel like with Margo's diagnosis, I really try and bring that in a lot to educate, you know, at the university level and, you know, different, you know, because we have many students in our cohort that have different disabilities and, you know, how to deal with that both as like in terms of the professors and also in terms of the students. And so we've also really been involved in fundraising a lot. That's been really important to us. And try to do this in some creative ways. MIT is really known for its glass pumpkins. Every fall, they have a glass lab and they sell pumpkins, and we were able to get some purple ones, which is the color of epilepsy, and make a big fundraiser on that, which was really fun. And then we really tried to get the dads involved. I think the moms, you know, take over a lot and do a lot of it, and we're very good at it. But, you know, our husbands are really important players too. And so my husband and another dad, Dario, whose daughter has epilepsy, and then Quentin, a daughter, dad whose daughter has autism, they're all athletes, and so they actually did a team half Ironman this summer, where Chris, my husband, did the swimming, Daria did the running, and Quentin did the cycling, and called themselves the Tri-Dadleets. And we fundraised a lot over that and made t-shirts for like Rare Dads Club and just really tried to like put the dads forward to do this. And you know, we were able to raise about $15,000 for research for that. So that was really fun to kind of try and get the dads in as well. So, you know, it's been quite the journey in terms of, you know, trying to find a way to accept the diagnosis. And I think, you know, now that we're 3 years in, I feel like people are like, well, how did you do it? And I don't know, there's not like an easy solution in order to, you know, kind of come, you know, it takes time. Like, it takes time to realize kind of what the life is, I think. And like I said, kind of really understanding the spectrum of Margo's disorder and kind of all the things that are going on with her. I think now we have a good handle on it. We have a good clinical team. We have a ton of medical equipment at home. We are lucky in Massachusetts. We get lots of great social supports and we get nursing. It's the reason that my husband and I have both been able to keep our jobs and that I'm able to travel and be here and do things like this, because we have such good supports. And Margo's in a great school and classroom with kids with disabilities, and, you know, kind of getting all that in place and finding all the supports in order to, you know, be able to not live in constant stress and constant overload and, you know, be able to enjoy life. And that's really important. And just taking the time to really, you know, accept what your child's life will be. And I think it's still really hard, especially I'm actually pregnant and due with another child. And, you know, I know having another child will also kind of make things different, and comparing and siblings and things like that. And I've, you know, heard a lot from different families about that. And I'm sure that will also bring up a lot of feelings. And so, you know, it's been finding, like I said, for me, finding community has really been kind of what sparked, you know, what allowed me to kind of find comfort and find a way to cope. But the other thing that really has helped is, you know, trying to do something about it in a way that I could. And, you know, my expertise is science. That's what I do. I'm a very rational, science-focused person. And, you know, our immediate, you know, reaction to getting the diagnosis was PubMed, which is the Google for science papers, right? Like, and we, you know, figured, you know, as in that we needed to, you know, really, as in the quote from that movie, science the shit out of this, right? This is like what we had to do, and this is what we were going to do. And so we've spent a lot of time the last few years slowly getting into research. And, you know, our initial thought, of course, was, well, what are therapeutic options? You know, what can we do? And so, you know, there are lots of genes now that are emerging as regulating, as driving these epilepsy disorders, autism, these neurodevelopmental disorders, right? The genetic source is clear. We know that. There's a lot of overlap between these genes. There are also differences, but there's a lot of genes. And so, you know, we immediately started thinking about what kind of therapies. And so a little background just to introduce us to the science. So DNA is the source of, you know, all of our, in our cells, of what makes us us, right? DNA is what controls everything that ends up happening in our bodies. It's what we inherit from our parents, and it is, you know, the source of everything that happens in our bodies. But DNA gets turned into this intermediate, which is called mRNA, which is an intermediate version that is similar to DNA, but slightly different. And then eventually, mRNA gets turned into protein. And proteins are the effectors in our body. They're the ones that actually get stuff done. And so the proteins are made from the DNA. So, you know, whatever our DNA says is what the proteins get made. And so if there are, you know, errors in the DNA, then this will impact the proteins. And so what kind of therapeutic options are there for genetic disorders? At the protein level, it's the drugs, it's the small molecules. And so, you know, these are drugs for example, for epilepsy that stop seizures, that regulate the activity of these proteins. And so, again, if, you know, Margo has an overactive channel that is causing too much electrical activity, so she takes drugs that try and block the activity of that protein to try and, you know, make it less active. And so, you know, these are kind of what's more common on the market. And so they don't get to the source, right? They don't touch the DNA, but they impact the proteins. Now, another approach would be to start, go to the source, to the DNA itself, and fix that. And that is broadly what we would refer as gene therapy. And, you know, to fix the DNA. There are, you know, a lot of challenges to that, and it's not something that we're still very good at for many genes, but, you know, that's the approach. And then at the mRNA level, there's been a lot of advances from a company in San Diego, Ionis, that is not that far, that's developed these little pieces of DNA that are called ASOs, or antisense oligonucleotides. And these are things that can be used to manipulate this intermediate stage of the mRNA. So what does this mean kind of therapeutically? So, you know, when you're thinking of a therapeutic for any genetic disorder, and especially one in the brain, there's different factors that come at play. And so one is, you know, how do you give it to a patient, right? The other is, how easily can it get to the brain? Because the brain is protected by this blood-brain barrier that, you know, is there in a good way to make sure that our brain doesn't get exposed to many of the toxins that can be in our body, so it's protective, but it also makes it a lot harder for things to enter the brain. And then there's how long it stays in the body. So how, if it stays for a short time in the body, then you need to give that therapy a lot. And so each of these approaches have different pros and cons. And so if we start with the drugs, they can, you know, it's still hard for drugs to get to the brain, but chemists have, you know, developed some good strategies so that you can take drugs that will go to your brain for seizures, for depression, for, you know, any kind of neurological disorder. But they don't stay there very long, right? And so you need to take the meds every 12 hours, every 24 hours, something like that. The genetic therapies you can deliver via the blood and or inject directly into the brain. So if you can inject directly into the brain, you can do that, but some are given in the blood. And a genetic therapy, the goal is that you give it once, and then that's it. Once, it fixes the DNA, and that's it. So that's one shot. And ASOs are kind of in between. And so the first ASO that was approved out of this company, Ionis, was Spinraza for spinal muscular atrophy, and has been really revolutionizing for these patients that have these motor neuron diseases, where if they start the treatment when they're born, they can have a pretty typical life. But there, you can inject it into the spinal cord like an epidural, and it will go to the brain, but it will only live for a few months. So you need to get an injection every 3 months. So pros and cons to each of these delivery approaches generally. So in terms of what we're trying to do, it really, in terms of a therapy, it really depends on what the mutation is doing to the gene. And I think that's something to keep in mind, because in these kind of broad populations, some mutations can make a gene more active and some can make it less active. And depending on what your mutation is doing, you might need a different treatment. So, you know, when we think of a gene and a rare disease, it's not necessarily that one treatment will work for everyone. And so for SCN8A, if you have a gene that makes it more a mutation that makes it more active, that is gain of function, where you have two copies of a gene, we all have two copies of each of our genes, one we inherit from our mom, one from our dad, and you have a mutation on one, and one is more active than the other, then what you want to do is reduce it, bring it down, so that you bring it back down to normal. So you have too much activity, and you're trying to bring it back down. But mutations can also cause a loss of function, where that one copy that's mutated doesn't work. So you only have one copy that's working. And so there, what you would want to do is increase the amount. And so again, it's when we're developing these genetic treatments, we need to know what the mutation is doing to the gene. Is it making it more active, or is it making it less active? And so different disorders have the same. And even within a single gene, and like SCN8A, what I talked about, like most of the kids who have the severe seizure disorder, like Margot, have gain of function mutations. And most of the kids that have no seizures and the more developmental, like autistic, ataxia, intellectual disability, have the loss of function. So it's like different features, and this happens in every gene. There's like, you know, different, most genes. So, and linked to disorders. So again, you need to know what's going on. And so, for Margot, at the protein level, there are actually two clinical trials ongoing for targeting the protein that is made from the SCN8A gene, which is really exciting to give more specific treatments. And these are going well, so that's cool. But it still doesn't really get to the source. And a big question in general in neurodevelopmental disorders is, you know, what can we fix with different therapies? If we just hit the protein with drugs, are we just kind of tuning different symptoms? Like, okay, we can maybe stop the seizures, but we're not going to help development progress because we're not actually fixing the source of the issue. But if we fix the source of the issue, can we intervene and still fix the brain, right? When can we stop, or when is it too late to fix the brain? We don't know all these things, right? These are all like huge open questions in the field of genetic therapies and neurodevelopmental disorders. When can you intervene? When, you know, is it too late to fix the brain? We don't know. So lots of questions, but we were really interested in trying to develop something that would fix more. At the DNA level, because of Margo's mutation, this was not an option for us. There is a new therapy or kind of new novel approach called CRISPR that maybe many of you have learned about that you can edit the DNA with, but that is still pretty far away in the brain, and so for us, that just didn't seem like a good option. And so our approach for Margo became to focus on the RNA, on ASOs. And that was because there was a study that came out right when Margo was diagnosed where they had developed an ASO. So again, it's a little piece of DNA that can recognize your gene and degrade the mRNA so that you reduce the protein that is being made. And this, in a mouse model, reduced the seizures of the mouse and made them live much longer. So this was really exciting. So, okay, if we can, you know, reduce the gene and put a bit less, then we can improve lifespan and reduce seizures. And this ASO was being developed by this company, Ionis, that I mentioned. And Ionis has also spun out this new approach called, or this foundation called Enlorum, which is a foundation that is spun out of the company where they are developing N-of-1 treatments for patients. N-of-1 means that if you have a mutation that is nano-rare, where there's less than 20 patients, they will develop a treatment specifically for that mutation. And that is an ASO-based treatment, and they will basically develop a treatment for your child. The goal is to do this with like lots of genes and to get, you know, learn, like kind of answer some of these questions that I talked about of like, can we fix a patient, can we fix the brain, right? If we fix the initial genetic issue, how much impact can we have? If we intervene in a patient that's 3 versus a patient that's 12, like can we have better effects if we intervene earlier? Kind of all these questions. And so initially it's a nonprofit that's doing this, but they are kind of wanting to do this for lots of patients. And so we wanted to do this and we said, okay, well, can we work with you to develop this? But unfortunately, this problem came up where Margot's gene is called a Goldilocks gene. And many genes in the brain can be like this, where if you have like the normal healthy amount of the gene, the brain is happy. But if you go too much in one direction or the other, the brain is unhappy. And so we know this, that you know, if we remove SCN8A completely in the brain, the mice die. They can't live at all. So we can't go too far in that direction because the brain needs this gene. And if you have only one copy missing, like some of the patients that I talked about, you still get a lot of different phenotypes. You get autism, hypotonia, intellectual disability, ataxia, lots of things. And if you have too much of the gene, then you get seizures and lots of other issues as well. And so it's called Goldilocks because if you have too much, it's not good. If you have too little, it's not good, and you need the perfect amount. And so this means that for many genetic therapies, you know, you need to really target well, because if you go too far, then you could, you know, cause damage in a different direction. And so many genes are like this, and so there are many genes where it might be really hard to develop genetic therapies because of this problem, which is really frustrating, right? That's how it is. So Ionis told us, no, we can't develop this therapy that we published in these mice. It was cool to show it in mice, but we can't actually do this in patients. And so we wanted to develop a different approach. Okay. So basically, I'll just introduce that Margo has, in her gene, has this approach where basically there are two versions of her gene. And this is regulated by a process called alternative splicing. And I don't want to go into the nitty-gritty details, but all I want to say is that for various genes, you can have different versions from the same piece of DNA. So if you have in DNA, for example, a blue box and a pink box in this gene, you can have sometimes the blue box is taken in to make the protein, and sometimes the pink box is taken in. It's just how it works. There's a lot of variability within our genes. And Margo has this feature in her gene. There's a region where there's two versions, a blue version and a red version. And the blue version is called the neonatal version, and the red version is the adult. And Margo's mutation is in the blue version, but the red one is intact. And so we thought, okay, well, maybe we can use ASOs, a different type of ASO that works differently, to prevent the blue one from being included so that the mutated version is not becoming used to make protein, and instead use the red box which is the same, pretty much the same as the blue one, but has no bad mutation and correct the protein. And so because, again, her mutation is in this region where there's these two versions, we thought we could remove the blue bad version and put in the good red version. And so we started to work on this. And we partnered with the company, but for me, I felt like that wasn't going fast enough. So I wanted to do that in my own lab as well. And so this is where I started collaborating with, turns out at my university, there's a lot of great people that work in epilepsy. And so I started working with a lab at Tufts, Chris Dula. We recruited a graduate student, Haley, to work on this. And we are working with Ionis, and this is Frank Bennett, one of the lead scientists there, to develop this treatment. And so we've had really good luck in the lab so far. We've identified some really great candidates for this to kind of develop this approach. We've tested them in different models. We've developed a mouse model for Margot with her own mutation where we can test the ASOs in mice. We also have her human cells growing where we're testing them there as well. And we've made really, really exciting progress kind of taking that into our own hands. And, you know, being able to do this research in the lab has really helped us cope and feel like we can do something, because no matter how much therapy or how many drugs we throw at her, you know, it's hard to control her seizures or help her develop. But in the lab, been able to make a lot of progress, and that's been really, really exciting and rewarding to kind of take that into my own hands and develop this treatment. So we hope that we will be we are currently in toxicology studies in mouse and rats, and we are hoping that we can inject her within a year. I don't know, it's slow. Who knows? I don't want to put a promise, but hopefully within a couple years. And so, you know, things we've learned along the journey that, you know, sharing our story has really helped us make progress for Margot and for SCN8A, and we've recruited lots of scientists in our community to come work in this area that weren't working on that before, just because we shared what we were doing. Building community has helped us feel less alone. You know, adapting to life with Margot is really important, and trying to find ways that still where we can find and do things that bring us joy within the limitations that we can do with her. And we've leveraged our unique skills and expertise in order to and follow our passion for science in order to develop a treatment for her. And so these are some of the people that are working with us, and our clinicians and our collaborators. And we've been able to raise, get some great funding to help support this. And so thank you so much for listening to our story. And I'm excited to be here with you all today.
I'm curious about, I have two girls that are neurodiverse as well. And we had one tested because they're identical twins of triplets. And they do have a partial gene deletion in chromosome 2. So I don't know. I mean, they're adults now. They're 21. So I'm just curious. I mean, it's so fascinating what you're doing. I mean, it's brilliant. How that will affect an adult at some point, or if you could, you know, do research, or if it's too late at this point. But it sounds groundbreaking what you're doing.
Yeah, I think we don't know when is going to be too late to intervene in terms of approaches. I think, you know, we don't know. The brain is a crazy thing. You know, we hear these stories of people who have like brain injuries and their brain can then relearn to do things and stuff, right? So I think it's just really hard to know. Like, and you know, the other thing is like, what can you fix, right? So again, it's like, if we give this therapy to Margot, can it fix the seizures, or can it also fix her development, or can it fix the other issues? And, you know, there are some early studies with different ASOs for other genes that show that you can do more. You can do more than just fixing seizures. And there's a child actually in San Diego with an SCN2A mutation, which is similar, who's received an ASO. There's some press on it in the last few weeks. And he was 15, never walked, and started walking. And, you know, also helped his seizures are better. But, you know, that's pretty amazing, right, that, like, that treatment could have such an impact on something that's so big. So I think, you know, there's a lot of hope and excitement. I think we just don't know, and we need to do more studies to learn and see, like, a lot to learn. We just don't know. But I think yeah, the potential impact is big.
Hi, I have a neurodivergent daughter, and I'm just curious, this research that you're doing, is it just specifically for your daughter's gene mutation, or is this something else? Because I have a little girl, she has Waardenburg syndrome and a rare mutation of Waardenburg syndrome, so I'm just curious, is this something that in the future you guys are looking to look at other disorders as well, or is this specifically for...
Yeah. So currently, this region of the gene in Margot that has these two versions, there's actually, now we know about 45 patients that have mutations in this region. So while initially the treatment will go to her through this N of one treatment, because it's like when you're doing clinical trials for these genetic disorders, you can do it for one or you can do it for a larger group in a trial, but doing it for a smaller group in between is hard. The goal, it will start with her, but this is, like I said, a therapy that, you know, we're learning more and more patients could be eligible in her gene. And then other sodium channels have a similar kind of two-version thing like this. So like SCN2A and so there are many patients in that group as well. So that would be a slightly different treatment, but the same concept and stuff. So that's kind of where we are expanding first. But like I said, there are kind of different genetic approaches being developed for other genes and, you know, by other people. And so, you know, there's a lot of interest in that way. But yeah, so that's kind of how we're approaching it. But focusing on this kind of area of these sodium channels. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your personal story as well as your research. In one of your slides, I saw you have tried 11 anti-seizure medications as well as the keto diet. I'd like to know a little more about keto diet and how it can be effective.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I feel like a lot of people don't know. The keto diet's been known. So it's been known that when you starve, your body generates ketones, which is like it does on the keto diet. And that was described by the Greeks, that if you starve yourself, you don't have seizures, for people who did have seizures. And then it kind of made a recurrence, this keto diet, or kind of like not starving yourself to generate these ketones, but eating differently to generate these ketones, in the last 100 years, and especially in the last, 40 years, it started to become much more popular as a treatment for epilepsy. You need to eat a really high fat diet, but they don't really know how it works. Like when we started it, and again, because we were scientists, we were like, oh, how does this work? And they're like, we don't know. It could be that it acts on the microbiome in your gut, and that relates back to your brain. And we know, that the gut has lots of neurons in it that can talk back to the brain, and that eating, can really affect your brain. So that could be it. They also think maybe these ketones themselves, which are generated from eating this diet, could be acting on the neurons differently. But yeah, they don't know exactly how it works, which is kind of crazy. The medical ketogenic diet is very extreme. Like Margot gets about 85% of her calories from fat. So it's like a lot of oil, butter mixed in with some food. But, for some people, it works really well. There's a lot of interest in using diet, for other disorders too. Now the keto diet's starting to be used for cancer as well and tested in other contexts. I think it can be harder, I think, especially in adults to adapt the keto diet because, at least Margot, she didn't eat that much before that. So that's kind of what she knows, but it can be hard to eat that kind of food when you're used to eating, a more balanced diet with sugar and stuff. But there are many kids, who start the keto diet for epilepsy in later years. People don't really know how it works. And some people tolerate it really well, and some kids do not. And, it causes lots of GI issues, and they have to get off it, and it's a problem. So sometimes, it's just not tolerated well by your GI system as well, which can cause issues. But it also, for Margot, it also, brought her personality to life. Like, initially, before we started it, she kind of was not really smiling and laughing and engaging. And, then when we started it, right away she started smiling and engaging more and being more alert. So it wasn't even just the effect on the seizures, which it helped a lot initially, but it also, you know, like I said, kind of lit her brain up in a great way, which was really cool to see that, like, just the diet could do that and something no other medication has been able to do. So, yeah.
I'll ask one if you don't mind. Yeah. well, again, thank you for sharing Margot's story and your journey. I mean, obviously, you know, one of the privileges your family has is you and your husband are scientists, and not just scientists, but geneticists and biologists. So you have a deeper understanding of the genetic information. I'm just wondering for families if you can share why it can be important to understand the genetics of a condition and what it can really mean for families. So if you could just share a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, I mean, the first thing is kind of finding a community of people that have that same mutation where, you know, it's not, you know, because even though with epilepsy or with autism, obviously there can be lots of similarities, even if it's a different mutation. But, you know, meeting other families that really have the same thing for us was really helpful, because sometimes there are conditions and treatments that work specifically for certain genes and not for others. So for us, for example, there's some seizure medications that are really bad and some that are really good. And so right away when we came in, they were like, this is like what works really well. You should try this. And that helped us kind of focus on things that are better known. So it can definitely help kind of in the immediate. And I know for certain genes too, there are kind of other things to look for. That, you know, sometimes clinicians don't really know about because there's so many different genes. And so having that insider information on that specific gene can be really helpful. And then it's also helping to contribute to the research. You know, I think once you have a diagnosis, then, you know, so in our community, we do this patient registry where then, you know, you fill out every year kind of questions on how your child is doing, and it allows you to collect a lot of data, and it allows us to understand, you know, like those kind of five categories that I showed you of SCN8A. Like, that's all because of, like, families, you know, every year filling out this questionnaire and sharing kind of what their disorder looks like. And so then it allows the clinical community too to really establish, like, what this is. And for SCN8A, for example, it's mostly associated with seizures. And so you get these families now who are coming in who are getting diagnosed based off of autism or things like that. And the clinicians are like, oh, no, that's wrong, because SCN8A causes seizures and your kid doesn't have seizures. And we're like, no, but this is also part of SCN8A. We're learning from our patient population. And so then they can go back to their clinicians and be like, no, like, there is a group where this happens, you know? And so it allows then kind of to gather that data and then, you know, educate the clinicians back. Because, you know, there's so many genes and rare diseases, and clinicians are great, but they can't know kind of all the different unique features of all of this. Like, it's really hard. So, you know, also sharing kind of, you know, just your experience and stuff can be really helpful. And, you know, if there are treatments that can be developed, the larger the population, you know, the more other biotech companies and pharma will want to invest. And so if they can know that, okay, well, this gene has, you know, 500 patients versus this gene has 30 patients, then, you know, they're going to want to invest in the one that has 500, because if they want to eventually do a clinical trial, then, you know, they need to have a good enough population. So just being counted, you know, and being like, yes, this is like what this diagnosis is, can really have an impact also kind of down the line in what happens in the community.
Okay. One last question.
So my son is on the spectrum. He's 15 now, and he's high functioning. But do you recommend us getting a gene makeup and workup? I mean, is that something that's affordable? Is it something we should do?
You can get it for free, I'm pretty sure. So, you know, if your child has a diagnosis of autism, then you can get it for free through Spark, exactly.
Okay, thank
you.
So,
yeah, and so now, you know, even for other broad diagnoses like cerebral palsy, epilepsy, there's a big push to get these tests, and you can get them for free. So it's, you know, it's very, yeah, affordable to do that. So, yeah. So, yes, I recommend it, you know, but, yeah.
Thank you.
Madeline, I just want to say how deeply touched that not only I feel as a mom and just in awe of everything you shared today, and then on top of it that you're a renowned researcher. And I wanted to say I think you can probably feel everybody's heart here with you right now.
Yes.
I feel it, and I think that's really the essence of Autism Tree, is that everyone that's here, we're having a collective heartbeat with you right now, and even for Margot. And I think I just feel really blessed by that, and it's our 10th anniversary. I kind of want to do, you're so good at selfies, I want everyone behind you, and we'll take, and I'll send it to you. You can go home with that. You guys all smiling? Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.